Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, and thanks to King & Wood Mellisons for providing this facility this evening. Thanks also to Gareth Narinsky and the Australian Israel and Jewish Affairs Council who have made it possible for Simon Henderson to speak here today. I'll introduce our speaker briefly. He graduated from Nottingham University in Britain, obtained an MBA at the City University in London, and currently is Baker Fellow at the Washington Institute, where he's Director of Gulf Energy and Policy Program, specializing in energy matters and the conservative Arab states of the Persian Gulf. And tonight, Simon Henderson's going to speak for us on the topic of the Saudi Arabia-Iran conflict. Simon Henderson, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming out this evening. I'm English. I talk like this. That's the way I am. I'm now a US citizen. I have a US passport in one pocket, and I have a British passport in the other pocket. And my American friends are very happy that I'm a US citizen, but they doubt whether I'll ever become an American. It's a work in progress. It's a role, as you're well aware, of a society based on immigrants. The immigrants have to contribute, and it's my contribution to the United States is my Englishness. I am a journalist by background. I started my career with the BBC in London. I then joined the Financial Times. I was a foreign correspondent in Pakistan in 77 and 78. And for those of you with memories which might go back as far as then, that is when Zulfikar Ali Bhutto was the Prime Minister until he was overthrown by the military. It was an interesting time to be in Pakistan, and it meant that when I joined the Financial Times a few months later, and the revolution in Iran was about to happen, the Financial Times sent me out to Iran. Not that I knew anything about Iran, but they thought if I could survive Pakistan, I might be able to survive Iran. My speciality at the moment, and indeed half the subject of tonight's discussion, is Saudi Arabia. I've never been to Saudi Arabia. This is because before I particularly wrote about Saudi Arabia, I wasn't prepared to go through the various hoops that they constructed in order to get a visa. And then I did start to write about Saudi Arabia, but if you write about the Saudi royal family, this isn't a quick way of getting a visa. A Saudi friend once said to me, he said, "Why do you have to write about the royal family?" He said, "We Saudis talk about the royal family and the politics of the royal family all the time, but we don't write about it." So I said, "Well, that's a different intellectual tradition. I come from one that if you only talk about things, you're considered a speaker of nonsense. And to be attempt to be somebody of substance, you have to write it down and have it published." And that's what I do. I write an enormous amount about Saudi Arabia. It's a very interesting country with some very interesting dynamics going on. That's mainly what I'm going to talk about this evening. We have the Middle East is a mess. You're going to say, when was it not a mess? I agree that that's a case. The unfortunate aspect of today's mess is that people are dying, people are suffering, and people are becoming refugees. And I'm meaning, and I say this in reference to Syria, I have no particular prescription of how to sort out Syria, but there are some good things which are happening in the Middle East as well, or there are changes which suggest it is some good might come out of it. My own particular background and particular focus is on energy. The Middle East is has, depending on how you do the numbers, 65% of the world's oil reserves and about 45% of the world's natural gas reserves. And when I talk about the Middle East, I mean the Middle East as a whole, but much of this is concentrated in the Gulf area. I call the Gulf the Persian Gulf. This irritates and upsets the countries like Saudi Arabia and the UAE, Qatar and so forth. I follow the discipline of the United States government on this, which has an organization called the Board of Geographic Names, which has looked in the background, the history, the geography, and decided it should be called the Persian Gulf. Having declared it should be the Persian Gulf, the US military then call it the Arabian Gulf because they have to actually work with the Gulf Arab states. And if they call it the Persian Gulf all the time, they upset the people that they want to work with. That is in the nature of the Middle East. Now, the energy-wise, which is the focus of much of the way I came into the Middle East, and the focus of the attention I give to the Middle East at the moment is a good story and an optimistic story at the moment. The price of oil, I haven't checked it today, but crept up to something like $49 per barrel a couple of days ago, and then there was a bit of a setback. Because I know you think Australia is the centre of the world. I think it's the bottom side of the world. So I can't work out whether what is today and what is about to be today in New York and Washington. But I think it's Thursday is about to begin in Washington. For the moment, the oil price is low, and this is good for the rest of us. This is good. It might not be good for oil companies, and it might not be good for for governments which like earning lots of oil revenue or tax their oil exports. But for consumers, it's good. And also, what used to be the perennial story of the Middle East, which was we were scared about energy security, is despite the problems of the Middle East and the people dying and things, there is the oil is continuing to flow. Now, Saudi Arabia and Iran, they clearly don't like each other. Is this antagonism going to worsen the economic situation or going to have no particular impact on it? Is it going to worsen the political situation and lead to continuing confusion for the next 10, 20 years? I'd say even beyond our lifetimes. We all get to a stage where we realise there's a it's the future is for our children rather than necessarily for ourselves. And I fear the answer is yes, but I don't think it's necessarily going to be cataclysmic. We should be able to live with these tensions. I don't want to give you a lecture about religious differences, but there are a few key elements of the division between Iran and Saudi Arabia. If I have to go into detail about it, I have to look things up to make sure I get the detail right. And you are very welcome to do so after this event anyway. But the essence of the division, the tension between Saudi Arabia and Iran that we have today, is a religious difference. And it's because there's a schism within Islam. The majority form of Islam, or most Muslims regard themselves as something called Sunni Muslims. People in Iran regard themselves as Shiite Muslims, and their Shiite communities elsewhere in the Middle East as well. The challenge here is that the Sunni Muslims regard the Shiite Muslims as not proper Muslims, or not even Muslims at all. And in extremists, they would regard themselves as so unworthy of being Muslims that they should be killed. That's one of the fundamental challenges between Saudi Arabia and Iran today. And so that is a major problem. The difference, in essence, for the Sunni Shiite aspect is, after the Prophet Muhammad died, it was a question of what happened to the succession of the title of the leader of Islam. The Sunnis thought it should go from those among the close followers of him, whereas the Shiites thought it should go from his relatives. This was complicated by the fact that the Prophet Muhammad didn't have any sons, he only had daughters. So the relatives were first line of the relatives was in fact the son-in-law of the Prophet Muhammad. Anyway, I digress, and having just mentioned the religious difference, I don't want to emphasize it too much. There are two other aspects of the difference. One is that ethnically, Iranians are Persian and Saudis are Arab. This is a big difference, at least to them. The main characteristic of which is the language. And the other difference is a geographic rivalry, which is that Iran considers it the principal country of the Middle East and regards itself as being the proper leader of the Middle East, but finds itself these days as not being recognized as the leader of the Middle East, and so is irritated by this. The Saudis are very happy not to recognize the Iranians as the leaders of the Middle East, because the Saudis themselves view themselves as the custodians of the holy places of Islam, meaning the cities of Mecca and Medina in Saudi Arabia. And they fear an Iranian challenge to this leadership. The additional dimension is energy, where things are much more even. Saudi Arabia has the world's largest oil reserves, notionally. Iran isn't so far behind. And in fact, Iran has the world's largest natural gas reserves, which is a great status to have anyway. And so there's going to be an energy dimension to what we're how this tension works out. The energy dimension, in the sense that each country wants to make use of its energy reserves, is in fact good for us, because it means that they want to pump, produce oil or produce natural gas, and sell it in quantities which will give them revenues, but they're going to sell it in such quantities that it'll keep the price down. That's good for us. There might be some of you who could argue that we want high prices for hydrocarbons in order to encourage a shift over to renewables, but frankly, that's another subject area, and we can perhaps tackle that in the question and answer dimension. Now, I was once put on the spot earlier this year by a colleague in front of a group of people and said, who said to me, why are we supporting Saudi Arabia rather than Iran? And it's a good enough question, particularly because it was at a time when earlier this year there had been a couple of horrific news stories which had emerged from Saudi Arabia. One was that a blogger who had blogged some criticism of Saudi Arabia had been flogged in public on a Friday after prayers in a mosque. I can't remember whether it was 40 lashes or 50 lashes, but either way, it wasn't a very pleasant experience. And there was another incident which was caught somewhere on YouTube of a woman who had apparently murdered somebody being executed by being beheaded in the street. The cell phone cameras are ubiquitous these days. It wasn't a great piece of video, but it was clear what happened. So how can one support a country which does this sort of thing? And the answer I gave was that these are unfortunate aspects of Saudi behaviour which should be condemned, and they should be deterred from repeating this sort of thing. But the Saudis are look to us, the West, the US, Europe, even Australia, as being their friends and allies, and they and so we should make use of that alliance, which they regard as a natural, in order to improve some otherwise distasteful parts of their behaviour. By contrast, the Iranians don't look to us as friends. They look to us as rivals and enemies. This is clearer to state in terms of the United States, where the Islamic regime, the Islamic Republic in Iran, views America as being an evil influence which needs to be outmaneuvered at all times. And they have a view of the United States whereby if they can push it out of the Middle East, that would be a good thing. The United States and Americans may want to leave the Middle East, but actually leaving the Middle East because the Iranians want to push them out of the Middle East is not a good thing. It will only lead to instability. Iran, this Iran, despite probably chunks of its population who are probably sympathetic to the West, but powerless in the power structure, this Iran is not a status quo country. This Iran wants to undermine the role of the West, not only in the Middle East, but also in the rest of the world. And that is something which we need to confront. Now, I'll draw my remarks to a little bit of a conclusion by talking a little about a curious aspect of this tension and the something surprising which has emerged as a result of this tension, the tension between Saudi Arabia and Iran, and a wider sense that Iran is up to no good. And what is happening is that there is a elements of a rapprochement between Saudi Arabia and Israel. Israel and Saudi Arabia have been enemies since certainly 1948, the start of the foundation of the State of Israel. Saudis have either on some occasions sent troops to fight against Israel. On most occasions they funded other people's troops to fight against Israel, and they've also funded the Palestinians. But because of mutual, what is apparent mutual fear and suspicion of Iran and Iran's intentions, Israel and Saudi Arabia are reaching out and talking to each other. Now, this is a work in progress. But let me give you a few examples of what is happening. And these are examples that if I had suggested them 5 years ago, people would have fallen about laughing and thought that I was a less than serious person. There is a Saudi prince called Turki al-Faisal, which essentially means he was the son of a king called King Faisal, who was died in 74, who spent 20 years of his career as head of Saudi intelligence and then became the ambassador in London and then became the ambassador in Washington. He doesn't actually have an official role at the moment, but in the last 2 or 3 years he's had public meetings with Israelis. Public meetings are meetings which we all know have happened and have been photographed and sometimes videoed. In the case of my own institute, the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, Turki al-Faisal was a guest speaker at our annual dinner in April this year in Washington, D.C. And he shared a platform. This is curious enough in the sense that my institute is identified as being supportive of Israel. But he, what was more interesting was that he shared the platform with a man called Yaakov Amidror, who is a retired Israeli major general, who then, after retiring from the military, served as Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's national security advisor for a couple of years. And at our annual dinner, these two men had a discussion about what they agreed with and what they didn't agree with. There wasn't actually too many areas of agreement, and there wasn't, to my mind, sufficient concentration on Iran, which was clearly the subtext of the reason why both of them were sitting there. But it was important enough that the event happened. Turki al-Faisal has also this year had his photograph taken shaking the hands of a man called Moshe Ya'alon, who is the, or was at the time, the Israeli Minister of Defense. They met at a security conference in Germany earlier in the year, and they sort of, what I think politicians call a brush pass, which is they walk close to each other, and they had their photograph taken shaking their hands. This is, these sort of things don't happen unless people want them to happen. In parenthesis, I should say that I was chatting to a former Israeli ambassador to Washington who told me that he had once found himself in the same lift, the same elevator, as the Saudi ambassador in Washington, D.C., and the Saudi ambassador blanked him completely, which he thought was, diplomatically, comprehensibly, understandable, but a bit rude in the circumstances, especially because there wasn't anybody else in the elevator other than their security people. Anyway, what we're also, another ingredient in this dimension is that there's another Saudi who's a man of less, who's not a royal and therefore has less status, but has also been doing this sort of thing. This is a man called Anwar Eshki, who was, when he was in the Saudi military, ended up as a major general. And last year, he had a public meeting at the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington, D.C., with a man called Dori Gold. And Dori Gold is a confidant of Netanyahu and is now the Director General of the Israeli Foreign Ministry. He's the top bureaucrat in the Foreign Ministry. And their Eshki's meeting with Dori Gold took place after Dori Gold had been named as being the next Director General of the Israeli Foreign Ministry, but just a few a matter of a few days before he actually took up the post. Fast forward to a few weeks ago, and Anwar Eshgi crosses into the West Bank and goes and stays in the Palestinian Authority and in Ramallah for a few days. And while he's there, takes a cab or whatever, driven down to Jerusalem. For those of you who know where Ramallah and Jerusalem is, it's half an hour's drive. And goes and have coffee at the King David Hotel, again with Dorrie Gold, and also meets a the Israeli general who's in charge of relations with the Palestinian Authority, because there are security arrangements in common between the two. And this again happens in public. It was only for 3 hours, and the rest of his stay in the West Bank was several days, but the 3 hours got the most attention. And he also had his photograph taken with a bunch of Israeli politicians, parliamentarians, mainly from left-wing parties. So where is this all going? And the simple answer to that is, I don't know, but I'm prepared to discuss it. The larger answer is that despite the historical tensions between between Saudi Arabia and Iran, and the historical tensions between Saudi Arabia and Israel, there are things which are happening. And there is movement out there. There are elements of a diplomatic dance. How long what the dance is, isn't clear. How long the dance will last, isn't clear. And whether they will take the next dance together or change partners, if I continue the metaphor, is also not clear. But this makes for a very interesting Middle East, a very and what's particularly interesting is that one's normal knowledge and prejudices of how things are going to work out, because you've been following it for too long and you know if A happened, then B is a consequence. We're now in a situation A happens and C is a consequence, and you never thought that C was even possible. And so, yes, the Middle East is a mess. The historical antagonism between Saudi Arabia and Iran is a important feature and likely to be a dominant feature as we go forward. But the other historical antagonism, which many of us thought was even greater than the Iran-Saudi Arabia divide, would appear to be in a process of being some adjustment, a perhaps even radical change. One hesitates to say it's going to get as far as that, because this is a work in progress. But this makes for an extraordinarily interesting Middle East, and one which could almost go anywhere. I will stop my remarks at this stage, and I'd be very happy to take questions.
Thank you. Many thanks to Simon Henderson for his talk tonight. Thanks also to King and Wood Mellison and to the Australia, Israel and Jewish Affairs Council for bringing Mr. Henderson to Australia and making it possible for him to speak here tonight. And so we come to questions and discussion. We've got plenty of time, but we don't have we do have a microphone. Okay. So just go back to the start of your talk. Obviously, in the context of Middle East, North Africa, Iran is a very revolutionary force, isn't it? Because the Sunni states say it's Islam is all closed down, it's resolved, and the Shiites say, well, hang on a minute, another prophet may turn up. And so this makes it a very revolutionary force, but it doesn't seem to be the problems that we're having in the West, that you have in the United States, that the British, the French, the Belgians, and in Australia to a lesser extent, but still the case. The problems that we have with Islamist extremism doesn't come from the Shiites, as we understand it. It comes essentially from the Sunni. A lot of it's funded out of, not the terrorism itself is funded, but a lot of the madrasas from which some of these extremists come have been funded by Saudi Arabia. So what's the clash between this conservative state that's essentially an enemy of the West and this radical state that's causing Saudi Arabia some problems, and but not so much the Western nations?
Yes, I accept your question. I don't think I accept all the little steps in it. There's too much terrorism which comes under the label of Sunni Islam. There's an unfortunate amount of terrorism which also comes under the label of Shiite Islam, and which has an Iranian flag very closely associated with it. The Iranians, the Hezbollah, supported by Iran, blew up a marine barracks in Beirut at one point. They blew up another military building in Al Khobar, Saudi Arabia. They blew up a Jewish community center in Buenos Aires. The Iranians' fingerprints on terrorism are clearly there.
That's the 1980s, though, isn't it?
Sorry?
That's the 1980s, isn't it?
Yeah, some of my colleagues track these things more closely than I, but there were Israeli tourists blown up at a bus out in Bulgaria just 2 or 3 years ago. If you are a Saudi or a Bahraini, you are constantly in fear of Iranian subversion. Although I sometimes think that these countries exaggerate Iranian subversion, I occasionally come across people who give me a chapter and verse of it. And I was speaking to a woman the other day who had been monitoring this stuff with the US military in Bahrain at one point, and her particular specialization was to work out where improvised explosive devices came from, IEDs, and while she was in Bahrain, the IEDs stepped up in their technological grading because of Iranian inputs. The Iranians, it's more than a theological difference, and it's more than a political aspiration. They're out there getting their hands dirty. Now, it used to be, I'm not quite sure, the extent to which the Saudis could be accused of the same thing on a Sunni side is doesn't stand up. The problem with the Saudis is that, at least in the past, and this is probably the case with 9/11, they were too careless with Sunni extremists and didn't pay enough attention to the threat they posed, and didn't challenge them and arrest them too often.
Thank you. There's a question there.
How stable do you think the House of Saud actually is, given its falling revenues, its fundamental welfare state's running massive deficit, economy for many, many decades? I mean, how stable is the House of Saud?
My standard answer, or at least this year's standard answer that I give to this question, because I get the question often, is along the following lines, that there isn't going to be a revolution in Saudi Arabia. It's a very conservative country. It's not in a it doesn't have a revolutionary tendency. However, and looking 3 years ahead, the Saudi Arabia that we would find in 3 years' time will look pretty well much as like Saudi Arabia today. And they're fairly big buts. I don't think the king of Saudi Arabia will be the same person in 3 years' time. The king at the moment is 80-year-old King Salman, who is both physically encumbered and mentally he's slowing down. I don't know who the next king will be, which is a way of saying I don't think it's going to be the designated crown prince, who's a nephew of the king. I suspect instead of that person it'll be the deputy crown prince, who is the king's favourite son, a man called Mohammed bin Salman, who's a rather surprise candidate because he's only 30 years old, which is a bit of a surprise because Saudi Arabia usually is very an age-oriented society. And I don't know when this transition is going to occur, and I don't know the circumstances in which it will occur. So that's... Check with me in 3 years' time on whether I got it right.
Thank you. Might you please share some of your thoughts and observations about what the Russians are doing in the Middle East? They're getting close to the Iranians, and they've been advocating trying to get access to some of the American air bases in Turkey, as you're probably aware.
Yeah. I got on a plane in Washington, D.C. on Saturday, so I've sort of been out of the news cycle for chunks of time, plus complicated by trying to overcome the consequences of jet lag. But I'm aware that this has become particularly significant in the last few days, and I did have managed to read a couple of good articles, which I've found in, I think, either the Financial Times or the Wall Street Journal in the last few days. I think the Russians, the Russians see the Middle East as opportunity at the moment. But I think, and this comes down to the character of President Putin, but the opportunity is hard to discern in terms of strategic terms. I just think he sees a series of tactical opportunities, and he's willing to take them. And because they're tactical, they're relatively small, which means that he, if they don't work out, he can walk his way back from them without any particular consequence. I think for the next 3 months or so, until January 21st next year, I think the Russians are going to be energetic, and their energies are going to be matched by a lack of energy in the residual weeks and months of the Obama administration. So I think it's a potential consequence, but whether it's of long-term consequence, I don't know. I think the Russian motive is to fill a gap. And they see an opportunity because there's a policy vacuum from the United States, and so they take that opportunity. But what it's going to mean in late January next year, when it's either President Clinton or President Trump, is anybody's guess.
There's a question here.
can we expect to see a succession of proxy wars between Iran and Saudi Arabia over the next decade or so, and how would you see it playing out?
Well, there are already proxy wars. I think the most significant war is Syria, where the conservative Arab states, like Saudi Arabia, were one of their reasons for trying to get rid of Assad was because he was an ally of Tehran, and they wanted to give Iran a strategic setback. This has so far failed to be accomplished. The rhetoric is that there are also proxy wars in Yemen and in Bahrain and in Iraq. I think Iraq is a bit of a lost cause. Bahrain is a war of words rather than anything more substantial. There used to be daily riots. There are no longer daily riots in Bahrain. And then there's the question of Yemen, which where the Saudis have got themselves into a military adventure, which they would have liked to have sorted out in a matter of weeks or months, but a year and a half on, it's a mess. And they can't appear to sort themselves out of them. I don't think Yemen is a particular consequence. I think Syria is the consequential proxy war. I'm not sure how that's going to work out. I mean, the essence of Iran's tactics is to try to use the minimal amount of people put a relatively small effort into a war. In Syria, they've had to put quite a large effort into a war, and they might be succeeding in Syria partly because of Russian involvement. I think what happens this week isn't necessarily what's going to happen next week, and the big unknown out there is, I'm afraid, the same answer that I gave here, which is, tell me who's going to be the next president of the United States, and I would be able to answer your question more confidently. You might not be happier with the answer, but...
I've got plenty of time. Can you speak right into the microphone?
My question's really about the impact of instability in Turkey. So given that the coup and sort of succeeding events has driven Turkey further away from the West and more to a, you know, an Islamic sensibility. How do you see that affecting the Saudi-Iranian conflict?
Turkey is a tangential thing to this. Saudi Arabia is at least one remove from what's happening in Turkey. Events in Turkey are both domestic. Erdogan's got a few problems with his military or whatever. They're to do with the power or relative power of Kurdish people in Turkey, for which there are also Kurds in Syria and Iraq and Iran as well, which complicates it. Watching what's been happening in the last few days in Turkey, I think Erdogan has decided it's his domestic focus which he has to concentrate on rather than any regional ambitions. And the domestic focus is to make sure that the relative strength of the Kurdish fighting groups is contained or diminished. so that they don't threaten or what he perceives as being a threat against Turkey itself. I think this is in the circumstances, I think this is I'm glad Turkey doesn't have wider regional ambitions at the moment, because Erdogan is as a spontaneous tactician as President Putin is, but with none of the apparent skill set for it. I mean, it's a great question, but the answer is you don't know the answer, and frankly, I don't know the answer, but I've managed to give you a framework in which, I hope I've managed to give you a framework in which to judge events.
Look, one small question. I'm interested in education.
Speak in the microphone.
Yeah. I'm interested in education and the economy in both Saudi, and this bears on the long survivability of the Saudi family. I've seen very large universities in Iran where you have massive numbers of people being educated. Admittedly, there's not a lot of jobs for them, but they are being educated, and they seem to have the capacity to diversify their economy in the longer term. And I get the impression in Saudi, perhaps because of my ignorance, that a country completely dependent on oil, where there's not a lot of steps taken in the education area to enable them to diversify their economy and to become much more sustainable.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see what you're asking. The good news there is that Saudi Arabia has just launched a new economic long-term plan, which they rather pompously call Vision 2030, which is essentially to make modernize the Saudi economy. But in declaring they want to modernize the Saudi economy and make it efficient, more efficient, it raises its own questions. And education is part of their sketched out scheme of what they want to do. But as we pretty well all know, the problem, one of the problems with Saudi Arabia is that if you've got relative oil wealth, you try to get other people to do the work rather than do the work yourself. But the way of modernizing your economy is to train your own people so that they can have significant roles in that economy. But that sort of education process, particularly if you're really trying to shift things, takes a generation or so to work things through, which raises the question of, do we have a generation to play with? And hence your question, and hence my caution in being able to declare a clear answer one way or another.
Yes, oh, great.
Do you think that the possibility of a Kurdistan, a separate Kurdish state, would increase stability in the Middle East? And is it now more possible, as a result of what's happened in Syria and in Iraq, where the Kurds were the ones that kept ISIS out?
Yeah.
I know that
I had this question a couple of nights ago in Perth. I thought, in retrospect, that I hadn't answered it well enough, and so I'm glad you asked it, because I've been trying to rework my answer. I think if there was ever a group of people which deserve their own state, the Kurds, and don't have a state, the Kurds are a good candidate for such a state. The challenge there is, as I commented earlier, there are Kurds in Syria, Turkey, Iran, and Iraq. And if you give if a Kurdish state is created, there are at least these four countries which would work to stop it happening. And so you can say it's a great idea, but making it happen isn't going to be that easy. And also there are, although there is a unifying Kurdish sentiment, these sentiments are played on by their current host governments. And so whether such an effort would have any chance of success is also questionable. I've always been a bit disappointed in the current quasi-nascent core Kurdish state, which is the Kurdish region of Iraq, which is the nearest thing to an independent Kurdistan that there is at the moment, which has the benefit of having oil and gas reserves and has had the success of being able to export certainly some of the oil reserves. And but they've made a complete economic mess of doing that. And instead of building an economy, they've used the revenues to hand out subsidies and create government employees, which doesn't augur well for the success of Kurdistan. And there's a final note to all this, which is that it's all very well to say, wouldn't it be a great idea? And it's all very well for me to say, yes, there are elements of it being a great idea. But in the Middle East, great ideas which are opposed by states or other people result in people dying far too often. And so who am I to glibly suggest a course of action in which people are going to die?
Okay. Take a last question.
About a decade or so ago, there was a great deal of hope among many commentators in the West that the educated younger generations of Iran were going to bring forth this new democratically styled Iran. It didn't happen. It's as theocratically or theocracy driven as much as any of the other Middle Eastern states. What do you see for the future? Is it always going to be this dictatorship or theocracy?
Yeah, I would hope not. I mean, the restraining factor in change in Iran is that the Islamic Republic as such, the governing structure, having got power, doesn't want to relinquish power. And, you know, for the at least the very simple reason is that they regard themselves as having fought and struggled for this sort of regime, which they have now achieved. I don't think it's a good regime, and I don't think it's good for the people. But and the, one of the things they fear, other than the sort of American military aggression, is the soft power of the people being unhappy with what's going on, and having street demonstrations and things like this, urging, pushing for political change. They regard such efforts as being destabilizing, which they would be, but they call it they identify it as being a velvet revolution. I think that's a rather good idea. They think it's the leadership in Iran thinks it's a bad idea, and uses dreadful and drastic methods to ensure that people don't pursue such ideas.
Final question, Duncan.
As we know, the immediate nuclear ambitions of Iran have been curbed for a period, which has led to Rashmong, particularly with the United States and the lifting of sanctions and so on. We also know that both Saudi Arabia and Israel are very unhappy with that situation. Is that part of the reason that they're talking to one another now? And generally, how do you assess the nuclear risk now at this point in the relationships?
The nuclear risk has been diminished and postponed, but it hasn't vanished. That is the optimistic pro-Obama view of it, if in Washington, D.C. The more cynical view in Washington, D.C. is that President Obama wanted a legacy achievement and was prepared to concede far too much in order to get a legacy agreement. Within the Middle East, Israel, the UAE, Saudi Arabia, other countries regard the deal as being a bad deal because it, for several reasons. One is they, instead of stopping Iran becoming a nuclear state, their interpretation of the deal was that it essentially confirmed Iran as being a quasi-nuclear state. And if you live in the Middle East, you are more sensitive to the parts of the subject which the deal didn't cover. It didn't cover ballistic missiles, for which the Iranians have a very energetic development program. Which they get away with by declaring that none of their missiles are intended for use to carry nuclear weapons. They might not be intended to, but they are capable of carrying nuclear weapons. So the countries in the Middle East are unhappy that they're continuing to develop such missiles. And more pertinently, on a day but more immediate basis, is that people in the Middle East regard Iran as being a subversive force, or Iranian Revolutionary Guard, or Hezbollah, etc., and the deal didn't do anything to tackle this day-by-day subversion. So Iran hasn't been taken off the table as a concern for these groups. It's still a worry, but not one which... but how you tackle that one, people put in a lot of diplomatic effort into achieving what they did, and they want to say, well, let's forget about it for the moment. It's in the nature of things. Can't we move on to something else? I fear, in the absence of tackling it, this is a problem which will come round and to bite us.
Many thanks. Well, it's great to have Simon Henderson here tonight. So much, of course, discussion that takes place on the area focuses more recently on Syria, for a long time, of course, on Israel. But there are many other nations in the region. So it was great to have Simon Henderson here today, talking about the Shiite Persian nation of Iran and the Sunni Arab nation of Saudi Arabia, and the relationship between these two nations and other nations in the region, including, of course, Syria and Israel and others. So I've learned a lot tonight. Thanks for your presentation. It'll be on our podcast tomorrow. It'll be published in the Sydney Papers online when we get around to doing that and Anne puts it out. So, but for tonight, many thanks for coming here and sharing us your informed views. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.